It would be a remarkable thing to look at a map of the world in 1811 and not be struck by how much of it was controlled by France and its 42-year-old leader, Napoleon Bonaparte. His writ ran from the Atlantic Ocean to the borders of Russia and from southern Spain to northern Germany. Some 45 million subjects lived under his rule. One exhausts superlatives in talking of his kingdom. He held sole command of a nation that was the richest and most powerful on earth. His empire was larger than the Roman emperors or Charlemagne's, and it had every promise of expanding in the near future. And Napoleon commanded it with such rigor that no detail, down to the opening time of the opera in Paris, escaped him. The emperor had not only conquered territory, he had remade societies. Coming of age during the reign of Louis XVI, Napoleon and his generation grew disgusted with a nation where the accumulated layers of tradition and artifice clogged one's path in life, and money and prestige flowed to the amoral and the cunning. They felt suffocated by the weight of the past, its irrationalities, its injustices. After taking power in France, Napoleon had streamlined the nation's administration, rationalized its civic laws and its economy to free up long-suppressed energies, and exported these innovations to the satellite nations under his control. He'd famously declared that careers should be open to the most talented, and in many ways he'd succeeded in moving European societies toward a future where merit, brains, and hard work counted. When the young general took power, he was seen across much of Europe as a kind of mythological creature, half warrior, half idealist. For those with any progressive ideas whatsoever, he was the strong man who would give order and structure to the best instincts of the French Revolution. Emerging from the whirling blood feuds of the Terror, during which thousands were executed on the slightest pretext, when men ran through the streets hoisting the body parts of princesses stuck on pikes, Napoleon had saved the nation. Our politics today are divided between left and right, liberal and conservative, but those notions gain their heat and shape from Napoleon's times. He came of age during the birth of those concepts, between the French Revolution's insistence on individual dignity, rights, and freedoms, and the Anglo-American conservative response inaugurated by Edmund Burke in his landmark Reflections on the Revolution in France, 1790, which stressed the value of tradition, caution, and social norms built up over time. The temperature of the early 1800s burned much hotter than that of the early 2000s. The eruption of the revolution threatened to sweep away all accumulated notions of social place and long-held values and to leave in their place pure chaos. Rulers eyed their subjects nervously, and subjects eyed their kings with the new idea that they were hateful and unnecessary. Europe in Napoleon's time seemed ready to fly apart. This goes a long way toward explaining why Napoleon aroused such intense admiration early on. Like George Washington, with whom he was often compared, he had taken a hot revolution and cooled it into a rational system without reverting to the abuses of the tyrant kings. "Peoples of Italy," the young general had cried after beating the Austrians there in 1796, "the French army comes to break your chains. We shall wage war like generous enemies, for our only quarrel is with the tyrants who have enslaved you." Words like that hadn't been heard in Europe before the revolution. Even some monarchists swooned at first. Napoleon took power in a 1799 coup d'etat, mid-stride in a series of wars that the French Republic claimed were fought to protect its borders and export freedom. For 16 years, he ran roughshod over opposing generals and kings. In 1797, the general had seized control of northern Italy from the Austrians. In 1800, he returned to Italy and defeated the Austrians. In 1802, he was named first consul for life. In 1804, he became emperor. In 1806, Napoleon faced the Fourth Coalition, Russia, Sweden, Great Britain, Saxony, and Prussia, and defeated them soundly. In 1807, he signed the Treaty of Tilsit with Tsar Alexander of Russia. In 1808, he invaded Spain. In 1809, he stumbled against the Austrians but stormed back with a punishing victory at Wagram. Napoleon's conquest had pitted him in a battle to the death with the monarchies of Europe. but even the opponents, who considered him an antichrist, saw him as an almost miraculous figure. He wanted to put his gigantic self in the place of humankind, wrote Madame de Stael, and even the young Tsar of Russia, Alexander I, at first regarded Bonaparte with admiration bordering on a kind of worship. It wouldn't last. The emperor's gifts were numerous and mutually reinforcing. An exacting self-discipline, a memory that was close to photographic, an ability to read people and fit their unspoken desires to his aims, a gut-level genius for inspiring men and leading them in battle, an openness to new ideas so long as he could benefit from them, a far-seeing, flexible, and often breathtakingly daring mind. His less appealing qualities were clear but not yet fatal. He was as superstitious as an old Corsican widow, petulant, headstrong, and, most of all, increasingly blind to the flaws in his thinking. His self-intoxication grew by the year. Napoleon had come to power through the military, and his career there was divided by a bright, sharp line. There was before Italy and after Italy. His unexpected victories there in 1796 against the Austrian army as an obscure general had changed his idea of himself and launched him into a career where he could seemingly do anything he set his mind to. It hadn't always been that way. Napoleon had emerged from his Corsican boyhood as a solitary, workaholic dreamer with immense, far-reaching gifts, but a slim chance at greatness. He was also superstitious, tetchy, and prone to childish rages, a man who rated his natural abilities very highly and grew suicidal at the thought that, as an obscure gunner, he would never get the chance to realize them. But Italy changed that, confirming to him that he not only had genius, but would be given a chance to display it. "From that moment, I foresaw what I might be," he wrote later. "Already I felt the earth flee from beneath me, as if I were being carried into the sky."